Correction, this is lecture numbered 15, not 14, as I have said in this. You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you're listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English, and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of a collected works by Rudolf Steiner, number 314, entitled Physiology and Healing, Collected Lectures. This is the part 6 in this book, which is an address, and that will be followed by a discussion at a meeting with medical practitioners. I will be separating those pieces. I'm calling this next address lecture 14, given in Dornach on the 21st of April, 1924. I think the main subject we need to discuss should be in response to definite questions put by you. I merely have a few things to say first, matters of principle. Real values have been lost in the course of human evolution because people have lost insight into the spiritual element, which truly is present in all things physical. Medicine is undoubtedly a field where most has been lost, the reason being that limiting oneself entirely to knowledge of the natural world must inevitably lead to all insight into the essential human being and human life being lost. Again and again we have to stress that the nature of all processes in the natural world is such that they cannot take place in the same way within the human organism. Let us leave aside the animal and plant organisms. The prevalent idea today is that a process that can be observed in the natural world outside can also exist in some way within the human organism. People talk of combustion and all kinds of other physical processes within the human organism. In fact, there is no such thing. Compared to something in the natural world outside, we have a self-contained human organism which, seen from the outside, is different from any object in the natural world. And every single process in the human organism is something thoroughly different. All processes in the natural world outside the human being have an effect on human beings, being constructive or destructive. To understand the essential human being, we have to accept three different kinds of degradation or destruction. The first kind of destruction happens from inside, in a way due to all the influences which Earth has on human beings. The powers of Earth destroy human beings from the inside. The powers acting from the air, mainly through respiration and transferred to the human being, bring in destruction from the Earth's surroundings. And the powers of light act destructively on man from the cosmos. Thus the powers of the cosmos, powers outside the human being, bring destruction in three ways. And destruction starts as soon as the capital I organization and the astral body are not acting on the human organization as well. Astral body and I organization counteract the destructive principles in human beings. Destruction due to extra-human powers must therefore begin the very moment when I and astral body are no longer active in human beings. This also tells us that we cannot in the least manage to understand essential human nature unless we gain more and more genuine insight into the higher levels of human existence, also when considering the medical aspects. Medicine has come to be mere experimentation, trying things out, merely because in more recent times people no longer dared to count on the higher levels of essential human nature, on the supersensible. It is, however, impossible to understand the disease process unless we see it as being connected with those higher levels. Nor can we understand the process of getting well, of healing, unless we see it in relationship to them. Let us consider the following. Destructive processes of the physical body and the ether body are mainly active in the human head. They actually make it possible for the astral principle and the I to be independently active in the head. That's a capital I. In the organization of metabolism and limbs, in everything connected with motor function and metabolism, we have the constructive, anabolic processes in the human organism of both ether body and physical body. I and astral body are most eminently active in these anabolic processes solely for metabolism and motor system. Astral body and I are active in everything that happens in metabolism. The I organization is active in all movement. We thus have I and astral body engaged in the system of metabolism and limbs. In the human head, they are exposed, as it were. I and astral organization are absolutely free there. To draw a diagram, see plate 7, we might have the physical head, etheric head, but astral body and I free, not engaged in the physical and etheric head. If, on the other hand, leaving aside for the moment the middle human being, the rhythmic blood human being, we consider the human being of metabolism and limbs, the etheric body is fully involved in the first place. It is so also in the head, but here astral body and I organization are also active, not left free inwardly, but bringing the processes about. Looking at a child, we have a complete connection between everything by way of astral body and I organization that is free in the head, and the principles bound to the physical organization as they are in the body, whilst in adults we do not have such inner cohesion. So that the whole body is not dependent on anything that happens in the head to the same degree as in a child. In children, the whole body is still wholly dependent on anything happening in the whole head. It is quite impossible to gain knowledge of essential human nature unless one really takes the higher levels of it into account. No one can really understand what goes on in the motor system, the metabolic system, unless they take recourse also to the mind and spirit. At best, one can draw on the head organization. It is inwardly very much taking its physical form from the way laws outside the human being apply. The head organization has an etheric body present within it and differs from organizations that are not human, but it is still most similar to the organization outside man. What does it really mean to understand a disease? Let us assume you are dealing with some organ in metabolism and have to assume a quite specific connection between the physical and etheric and the way in which astral body and I organization intervene in this organ, let's say the liver. Astral body and I organization must intervene in a quite specific way. The moment they withdraw a little from this organ, it will grow similar to the head organ. And one must always keep in mind that when any metabolic organ, and also anything connected with metabolism, shows an irregularity, astral body and I organization are not sufficiently involved in the organization of the organ concerned. It is the other way round in the head. If astral body and I intervene too much, a morbid state develops in the human head. The head is really the part of the human being that is inwardly most strongly vegetable and mineral in disposition, whilst motor and metabolic organs are most strongly animal and human. People really only see the opposite of this. They think the head organization is most spiritual in organization. Yet, when the head organization becomes the most spiritual, the conscious mind gets clouded. Now, the moment processes coming from I or astral body do not intervene sufficiently in the organism of metabolism and limbs, The moment the system of metabolism and limbs grows similar to the head system, this system will be morbid. The physician's approach must therefore be to ask, quote, when I see that a disease involves clouding of the mind, how do I prevent this? I have to prevent the eye and astral body from intervening too strongly, close quote. Or, quote, how do I manage to get the astral body to intervene more strongly where its intervention is not strong enough, close quote. Now, you see, these things show the extraordinarily great role which the way of thinking, the method of thinking, plays especially in medicine. Yes, we must indeed know the medicinal substances, the medicinal agents. But you will be perfectly right in asking how one will get to know the medicinal agents. We cannot get to know them unless we first gain living experience in mind and spirit of what is truly going on in the human being. To do so, we need a particular way of thinking. This is what I really wanted to say by way of introduction, that the physician must be wholly given to a particular way of thinking. Initially, for instance, I'd say one has to start with things that are more outside, in nature. The physician must first of all understand that everything we may call heat, light, and so on, really exists in two ways. You see, initially if it's summer, light and warmth come down to the earth from the sun. Sunlight and the heat of the sun take hold of everything on earth that is sprouting, shooting, about to flower and bear fruit. And things that flower and fruit are essentially interesting for us, because they are vehicles for the sun's light and heat. But how are things in winter? In summer, the sun's light and heat enter into the soil. Staying in the earth, the sun's light and heat continue to be active through the winter. Light and sun thus have to be considered from two angles. But when we look at the sun's and altogether the cosmic surroundings effect on earth, we realize that all of it has an effect on the human system of metabolism and limbs. The whole system of metabolism and limbs is already affected by influences from the cosmos. Everything in the head is influenced by cosmic powers that have been preserved in the earth. In this respect, the human being is upside down on earth. The system of metabolism and limbs is affected by influences from outside the earth, cosmic influences. But you can extend this to every single substance. Take lead, for instance, lead being a definite medicinal agent for certain things. We find lead in nature outside the human being to be as it is, to be as it has arisen through the totality of cosmic powers. When it exists because of the cosmic powers, it will most eminently act through the system of limbs and metabolism up into the head. If we melt the lead using an earthly process and subjecting the lead to it, it will act directly on the head system. This is why there is such a great difference. Antimony, gray antimony, glands, is an important medicine we have. If we take the fibrous ore existing in the world outside, the spear-like habit comes from the cosmos, we have a medicament which acts on metabolism. If we subject the antimony to an earthly process, making it into a black mirror deposit, we get a specific action on the human head. Now you see, with this way of thinking, it is a matter of entering not only into the substance, but also the processes, into what is going on. It is not right to say that lead is a medicine for this or that. It is a matter of knowing how the process went, if we have a raw material, or if the substance has been subjected to some process or other. The way substances are treated, that is essentially what matters. And we ought to stop looking for the medicinal property in the substance as such. We should more and more say to ourselves, if there's a disease, it is a process that is not embraced by the human organism as a whole. If we want a medicine, we must strengthen the organism. We must subject the human being to processes that we fully understand. This is what matters. I now want to tell you something that is the aim and purpose of the whole of this introduction. It may seem paradoxical at first, but it needs to be fully grasped in the whole of medical life. It is this. You have to study all the processes that need to be studied in the universe to establish if they are cosmic or telluric or processes where both come into it. We have no way of really getting to these processes unless we are able to understand how the soul element, S-O-U-L, is also differentiated into three different regions in the threefold human being. It is really not possible to get to the human being in any real way unless we understand the soul principle. And you see, for this, we have to consider the following. The soul principle really has much greater unity in adults than the physical organism does. The latter is clearly differentiated into three: neurosensory system, rhythmic system, and system of metabolism and limbs. These must be distinguished. The soul principle fills the head system, the neurosensory system, as much as it does the rhythmic system, and also metabolism and limbs. In the lower system, it is very sleepy, dreaming, but it does fill the whole human being in his three aspects. Now, if someone is meant to develop one system especially, that is, if the soul principle is to pour its activity especially into one system, what happens in that case? I think you'll agree that a person can be busy thinking, he can walk, occupy himself using his hands, his legs. We'll have to consider the middle system separately. But what happens with the soul principle when a person is busy with an activity or is walking? When a person walks or works with his hands, it truly is the case that the same power comes to expression in everything in the world we call love. This remains in arms and hands, in legs and feet. Readers aside, bracket, there's a missing text here, close bracket. Human beings have to go to the limits of their skin when they stir into activity. And when this flows out beyond them, it unfolds as love. What does it mean to say someone is walking? It means he lives and loves the human organism within his skin. It means he makes the necessary effort with his astral or eye organization. And in walking, he works his eye organization in such a way that he draws it out to some degree of his physical and etheric organization. Human beings withdraw their astral limbs and eye limbs when they walk. Stretching their legs as they walk, they are withdrawing astral body and eye. Thinking, they shine them in, only as far as the skin, of course. If we take this into account, we can say that in getting the organism going, we simply have the beginning of morbidity. You get morbid states when astral body and eye organization withdraw from the system of metabolism and limbs without the individual lovingly filling his organism. When etheric body and physical body are filled completely in the head, and it is not from arbitrary choice, you'll again have morbid states. Anything a person does arbitrarily will immediately afterward correct itself. Daily life in thought and motion, it is a continuous process of making ourselves ill. But the human organism is immediately able to restore health to itself. To understand these things depends on being truly able to have enough love for what is going on in a case of sickness, so that we can look at it as something which really shows us the spiritual in the human being in a physical way. You see, when someone develops liver disease, does in some way develop abnormalities in the liver, let us say, his astral body is not sufficiently active in the liver. What kind of mental activity involves a similar process? It is when I take a particularly great inner interest in something external. The moment someone looks at something with great attention, that person really has liver disease. The astral body is withdrawing from the liver in that case, but the situation is immediately corrected. Going through the different disease processes in the human organism, we can always see what happens in a healthy individual through arbitrariness, through arbitrary life. If the arbitrary processes were not always balanced out again, people would make themselves sick all the time with those processes. It is therefore possible to learn how the soul principle, the spiritual principle, is, if we like, disease processes, is, if we like, disease processes as study processes. Let me read that again. It is therefore possible to learn how the soul principle, the spiritual principle, is, if we like disease processes as study processes, truly love them. This love for the diseases must, of course, be combined with something else. We don't just want to study the disease. This is of lesser significance. But if we are able to cure, what do we have then? We have insight into the way in which the divine world has come into existence. The world has been created out of all kinds of different spiritual activities and entities. And that is the first step in the physician's work. To say to oneself that disease processes take one to insight into essential human nature. They are genuine insight processes. The healing processes can only be grasped, however, in a religious mood. Everything a physician does must be filled with a religious attitude to the world. Without this, insight will never be ours in the individual case. Of course, you can always say to yourselves, well, here we have the medicines, and anthroposophy comes along to tell us which to use. But one can't really understand the whole of it. You can understand it if you consider things like those I have just been characterizing. If you can penetrate a genuine process of gaining insight for diagnosis and a genuine process for treatment. These things must be taken very seriously. This must be our attitude if we want to understand everything said from the anthroposophical point of view in medicine. For application in practice, we have to go into detail. But it is necessary to let this attitude prevail in everything one does in medicine. I'd now like you to ask further questions, so that we may move on and consider actual situations tomorrow. It has been my intention merely to bring in the qualitative aspect. And there's a first question. As a physician, one is sometimes forced today to use medicines which one does not like to use. And some of those medicines are surely such that they should not be used. Would it not be possible to say something about medicines which we should not be using? And Rudolf Steiner again. I'd like to say the following in response to this question, wholly in principle. There is a great difference between saying, quote, I see how this medicine works in the human organism, close quote, and, quote, I do not understand it, close quote. Initially, the difference is, of course, relative when it comes to practice. So long as we do not have medical faculties where one has courses of the kind it is possible to teach in anthroposophy. Until then, it will happen again and again that practitioners make notes also of recommendations made on the basis of anthroposophy. This is a medicine for this or that. We who are here would, of course, like nothing better than to start presenting insight into essential human nature, so that looking at an onion, we know how the onion process acts in the human organism, the antecedents being such and such. We'd certainly like this better than anything. But initially, it is relative. And for the time being, it is only possible to speak of a medicine for this or that. We are, however, most unlikely to speak of a medicine where we do not know how its action continues on within essential human nature. It will not be said, for instance, that silica from Aquasetum should be taken unless we know exactly that it evokes a kidney process. The hyper-excitability of an irritable kidney is reduced by it. Hyper-excitability of the kidney is thus reduced, if you provide the kidney with silica from Equisetum. That is understood, therefore, and one would need to know. Reader's aside, and there is text missing here. End of reader's aside. But let me ask you, confidentially, how are investigations done out there? They are done very superficially, using statistics. They are done by giving the medicament to so and so many patients. People do not really know what is going on. And above all, the big difference between a genuine medicinal agent and one of this kind is that one fully understands the process and knows how it influences the whole of human life. If you successfully treat something with some medicament or other today, you will not know what this will lead to in 5 years' time. But if you fully understand the process, you will above all need no statistics. Statistics never come into it with our medicines. The book, which is due to appear soon, will tell you that it does not depend on statistics if a medicament proves effective or not, but on study of the individual case. If you have a box of matches and test the matches, you'll not light all the matches, knowing that once you have lit one of them, they can all be lit. You also know that every process has to go the way you know it does. So it is not a matter of statistics, but of fully understanding the individual case. Because of this, we'll always have great problems when people say, hand over your medicines for testing. This will not get us anywhere. It will not create confidence in our medicines. Yes, statistics will give extraordinarily good results with our medicines, but the usual cases either have not been diagnosed correctly, or they are cases where other things are needed as well. In my opinion, the real point with medicines that heal is to understand, above all truly, to understand how things go. You see, strangely enough, even to test things leads to all kinds of interesting things. There are all kinds of medicines for syphilis today, and arsenic is always involved. Why? We say that arsenic is something which stimulates the astral body when it is not greatly inclined to intervene in the physical body, so that it will intervene more. This astral body is stirred to action by giving a person arsenic. The medicines investigated in tests are really based on this. Now you can also see how people are deceived, how illusions come in. You rely on the intense action of arsenic in cases where the astral body truly can gain such strength with arsenic, and only arsenic will really cure syphilis. We really must always fully understand how such medicines act. It should be our aim always to do so. Our way of thinking must become more and more widely known, and our aim in producing the book is indeed to introduce the way of thinking we seek to cultivate here, and not so much to suggest medicines. It will also be important to refer to this way of thinking when it comes to medicines that are not suggested by us. There are good medicines also outside our sphere, and one will give the one or the other as need arises. And now there's another question. We talked about asthma here the last time. You said that one should meditate on breathing. Are we entitled to give a meditation in such cases? I could not think of anything else. I found a verse by Goethe, and here's the verse by Goethe, quote, "In every breath lies twofold benison, drawing air in, letting it out again. Oppression first, and then refreshment comes. Life wondrously combines the two. Give thanks to God when he oppresses, and thanks again when he releases you." Close quote. Continue question. I was not sure if that was the right thing. Rudolf Steiner again. You see, with things like that, it does have to be accepted that because they are halfway, if you like, or three-quarters psychological, your response must also have soul quality, if your attitude is such as I have spoken of today. The way human beings are in the earthly world, and through their head in the cosmic world, when physicians have learned to think and feel spiritually, and also approach their patients in that way, then it is reasonable to do so. But if you approach patients with the attitude which is so common with the materialistic view today, not really caring about them at all, you will generally achieve the opposite of what you really want to achieve. You see, many people turn up again and again today, and physicians also do not completely exclude it, who work with things of this kind. They will sometimes ameliorate conditions, but not cure them. If the patient is made strong by it, the amelioration may actually lead to a cure. But when people ask if you can really achieve this, I have to say that it will be possible if you truly love the patient. But it will not help if you are indifferent to the patient. We should really have the courage to heal. This is why I have always referred to the courage to heal at our institute here, where that is the case. The worst thing you can do if you want to heal is to think of death when you have a patient before you, however sick he may be. As a physician, one should really forbid oneself to think of a patient's death as any kind of possibility. The imponderables are indeed most powerful. You have the power to strengthen someone enormously if, come what may, you put aside the thought of death to the very last moment, and think only of what you may do to save whatever can be saved of the power of life. Many more people are saved when this attitude is developed than when the other attitude develops, where the prognosis, based on one thing or another, somehow is death. This is something you should never do. And things like this must indeed be properly taken into account. You are then justified in having the will to heal. And there's another question. Working as an assistant at a hospital where you have to prescribe morphine and other drugs, is there anything else that can perhaps stop the action exactly because of one's attitude to the patient? Rudolf Steiner again. You can achieve much just by your attitude, but if intervention is necessary using physical substances, these should, as far as possible, be taken from the plant world and not be derivatives, depending on what you feel is needed, using the actual poppy juice, for instance. And this not in thinking of the inner processes, quite the contrary, but turning to the outer form of the plant, that which delights us in it. It is difficult to give rules for such things, for even if you are forced to give the medicament, your attitude plays a great role if you capture what shows itself in the patient. You need to take note of the mood which shows itself in the patient with the medicament, and then you can intervene. The medicine has made the patient more transparent with regard to the help needed. We'll continue tomorrow, and I'd ask you to put all the questions that cause you concern. This is the end of the address, which I'm numbering as Lecture 14.